Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My three guests today are all storytellers. One tells stories in written words, one in spoken words, and one in pictures. Later in the hour, we'll hear from Teresa Jordan, who recently told a story on the Moth Radio Hour. She is author of The Year of Living Virtuously, Weekends Off. Local storyteller Nancy Leek has a new book for children and adults, illustrated by Steve Fershad. Nancy Leek is a librarian who has worked in public, school, and academic libraries. She writes about Northern California history in her most recent book, as well as two previous books, John Bidwell, The Adventurous Life of a California Pioneer, and John and Annie Bidwell, The Long and Short of It. Nancy Leek, welcome.
Thank you.
Award-winning illustrator Steve Fershad has been drawing for as long as he can remember and has illustrated over 30 books, including Nancy Leek's book about John and Annie Bidwell. Steve and Nancy have collaborated on this new book, Nancy Kelsey Comes Over the Mountain, The True Story of the First American Woman in California. Steve Fershad, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I don't know, Steve, if you consider yourself a storyteller. Have you ever thought about that?
Yes, because in a way you are just telling stories with pictures, you know, and as they say, a picture says 1,000 words, so I have the easy end of it, so.
Particularly if you're aiming this book at children. Nancy, what age group would you say you thought or had in mind when you wrote this book?
I had in mind 2nd to 4th grade, I would say.
You know what I find about your books is that I, as an adult, like the fact that you tell your story concisely. And particularly John Bidwell, I've read books, and his life is so fascinating that I like reading the thick books. But I can see the overview when you write your book aimed at a younger audience or younger readership.
Yeah, sometimes it can be hard to squeeze it down to the essentials.
I'll bet it is, because with somebody like John and Annie Bidwell, there is a lot known about them and their lives. But not so much this person that you chose to focus on in this book, Nancy Kelsey.
Well, Nancy Kelsey was the only woman in the Bidwell-Bartleson party to come to California in 1841. They had set out from Missouri. She was with her husband. And the original party had about 60 people in it. But when they got halfway along, they split up. Half of them went to Oregon. That was the safer route. The other half, 32 men, one woman, with her baby, decided to risk it and go straight to California across the desert. And she said, you know, people warned her. In fact, even before they left Missouri, people told her, you know, let your husband go. He can go check out California. And then, you know, if it looks good, he can come back for you. And men did do that. But she said, where my husband goes, I can go. I can better endure the hardships of the journey than the anxieties for an absent husband. She was only 15 when they married.
Yeah, I saw that she turned 18 after they started the journey.
On the journey, yeah.
On the journey, and she had been married at 15. And for one thing, I suppose people didn't live as long. And so they got on with their lives at a much younger age than we do today.
Well, I think back then, if you were, you know, from the backwoods of Kentucky.
Which is where she was born.
Which is where she was born in 1823. You know, once you reached early teenage years, that's what you did. You found a husband and got married. Started a home, started a family.
And that's what she did. Well, we mentioned just now that she was born in Kentucky. And her family moves to Missouri, which was kind of the jumping off. Now, well, it's where people started this journey to the West.
Yes, yes.
That they did. And she thought that she, in the title of your book says, The True Story of the First American Woman in California. And that's what she thought she was.
She always thought she was. I mean, I had to be accurate. When she got to Sutter's Fort, there was another American woman already there. Mary Walker was the wife of the explorer Joel Walker, brother of Joseph Walker, who's the more famous one. They had come down from Oregon Well, that's easy compared to crossing the Sierra Nevada. And so, and Mary Walker didn't stay in California. Nancy Kelsey stayed, and she had made that trek over the mountains carrying her little girl. That deserves a lot of credit.
So the title of your book is Nancy Kelsey Comes Over the Mountain, The True Story of the First American Woman in California. And on this cover, Steve Fershad has shown us a picture of Nancy Kelsey. And what else? Describe your cover, Steve, that you drew for this book.
Well, the cover is, as shown, is just Nancy Kelsey carrying her infant, walking over these rocks that I would assume would be there at the pass, and she's barefoot. That was very important, that by the time she reached Sierra Nevadas, her shoes were all worn, so she had to cross them barefoot.
And so this was not your imagination. When you drew her without shoes on, you knew that that was the way she reported it herself.
Yes. Yeah, Nancy is very detailed in descriptions and what needs to be in the illustration. Then I sort of take
now
it from
you're
there.
Saying that Nancy Leake, the author, is
Nancy
very
Leake,
specific.
Yeah, yeah, I'm not no psychic or medium in talking to the actual Nancy. Yeah,
there's a lot of Nancy's in this story here. Yeah.
So Nancy Leake was detailed in what your illustration should be, and she was basing this on what Nancy Kelsey wrote down when a friend asked her to tell her story.
Yes.
So we have Nancy Kelsey on the cover in bare feet with her baby in her arms, and she is walking, whereas you turn the page and she's sitting on a horse. So why was she sitting on a horse in the first page of the book, on the first page of the book, and walking on the cover?
Because it just made for a more dramatic cover. If she's on a horse, but just the idea that she just walked. And a lot of times, most of them were on foot most of the trip anyway. And like I said, and it gives her that, the strength of her. You know, she's holding her staff, her walking stick, and she's not looking haggard or anything. So it just shows
she looks quite fresh.
Yeah, it shows this very strong woman making the journey.
And her husband is actually in the background on a horse.
Oh, on a horse, yeah.
But I would
And there's a bear.
Yes, and there's a bear on the other side of the illustration.
There
the
were
mountains.
A lot of grizzly bears in California in those days.
So you made the suggestion to Steve, when you're drawing this cover, put a bear
in
the picture. Yes.
And make her look determined and strong, you know. Like I said, Nancy's great at feeding me the details that an illustrator does need.
To carry out.
Oh, yeah, and she does all the research. She hands me photographs. Everything. She's very easy to work with.
Well, I thought perhaps the reason you have at the start of the story her on a horse, because that's how she started the journey.
Yes.
She did have a horse. Mm-hmm. She was on horseback, and her baby was riding there on the horse with her.
Yes, for most of the journey. Once they were in the mountains, though, it was hard to be on the horse.
So that's why I thought there was a difference in when she's walking over the mountain, she is literally walking on her own 2 feet. And when she starts the trip, when the story begins in your book, Nancy Leake.
Mm-hmm.
She is on a horse. So, Nancy, why don't you start with that, your story, and tell us how you knew what her words were. How did you have the actual words of Nancy Kelsey?
That's an interesting point. There's very little on Nancy Kelsey, but very late in her life, someone came and interviewed her at her home in the Cuyama Valley in Santa Barbara County, and asked her to tell her story, which was published in the newspapers. And since she didn't actually write it down herself, I thought for a long time that she was illiterate. But I later found some letters that she wrote to a friend of hers who at, you know, one time, and I thought, oh, well, she could read and write. You know, her spelling's a little wonky sometimes, but she could read and write. But she didn't actually write down, she dictated her memoir. Mm-hmm. And so she tells her story. And she starts out saying, so it's my history you want? Well,
I wondered that myself, if she did know how to read and write.
Yeah, evidently she did.
The very first, the inside of your cover, you have a quote by Nancy Kelsey. So it's my history you want? Well, it would make a book.
And so it would.
And you did. You made a book out of her story.
Yeah, so she says, you know, when they're up there in the mountains, she says, I was left with my babe alone, and as I sat there on my horse and listened to the sighing and moaning of the winds through the pines, it seemed the loneliest spot in the world.
So this is author Nancy Leake reading the actual words of Nancy Kelsey. this woman who crossed over the mountains and was telling this story to a friend, and the account was published in newspapers. So you had access to newspapers with her own account.
Yes.
So when you say these words you just read, you are actually saying the words that Nancy Kelsey
right.
said.
And she was sitting up there alone because the men had gone ahead to scout out a route, and they'd just left her by herself. And it's lonely up there in the mountains with the wind sighing in the trees.
And it would, I think, be scary enough if you only were responsible for yourself. But here she has this little...
How old was her baby at the time?
She refers to her babe. How old was the baby at that time?
Her daughter's name was Martha Ann. They called her Baby Ann a lot of the time. She was born before they started out. She was probably about a year old when they started. So by the time they get to California, she's about a year and a half.
And she is holding her baby, and she's left there when they go out to scout. And you mentioned that she was the only woman in this company of mm-hmm. pioneers. So the men have gone on, and then the next, and then you have an illustration, lovely illustration, Steve, of her sitting on her horse with this, with nobody else in sight, just the trees and the mountains and the sky.
And a little artistic license. She was barefoot at the time, but I figured if it was cold, they would have wrapped cloth around her feet. So that's why.
So when she's on horseback, she has some. She has her feet
just
wrapped up.
Yeah, wrapped up, yeah.
And so technically, that's not shoes.
Yeah, it would have been cold. It would have been cold. It was October.
And she's wrapped up in this blanket as she's sitting there. Then the next picture, we have her talking to another lady. And Steve, what did Nancy tell you she wanted in this sketch, this illustration?
Well, one, it was very specific that it wasn't a luxurious cabin that they were living in.
So in the background, these two ladies are talking.
Talking in front of this very
Nancy
simple
Kelsey
cabin, yes.
Has her baby in her arms, and there's this really rough log house.
Cabin, yeah. Because the first illustration, the sketch, it actually showed her inside with actually nicer furniture that they probably didn't have. So like I said, she's very good to work with because she does know the detail. And she actually found a picture of a cabin. And I think the only thing she could find a picture of was a young picture of Nancy Kelsey. So we sort of had to take artistic license with that.
So you knew what to draw when Nancy said, I need a cabin in this illustration.
Yes, she actually had a photo or a sample of one. So like I said, she makes it very easy for me. So.
And so then Nancy Kelsey, the young woman in this story, had just turned 18. She had been married when she was 15. And her husband was not the type to settle down. He didn't have a farmer personality, did he? Nancy, you're shaking your head.
No, he was the hunter-trapper type. And even after they came to California, they never settled down in one place in California. They moved. They lived in Sonoma. They lived in Arcata. They lived in Inyo County. They lived in Los Angeles. They were all over the map in California.
And fortunately, Nancy went along with it. She said, I'd rather be with my husband than be sitting there worried about him.
Mm-hmm.
So they joined this company that we're familiar with. If you know the story of John Bidwell, you're familiar with this group that he is partial leader of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
John Bartleson was actually the leader of the company, and John Bidwell was the secretary, and he was keeping a record of the journey.
Which is where we get a lot of the information about this overland trek, is from Bidwell's journal.
Mm-hmm. So you say they start out from Missouri. And what kind of things did they take with them? What do they put in their wagon when they're preparing to leave?
That's something I always like to talk. When I talk to fourth grade classes, I tell them, I give them the setup. You're going to be taking this 2,000-mile journey. There are no stores. What are you going to put in your wagon? And then I asked them to give me ideas about what they would put in their wagon. And it's interesting to see what they come up with and what I have to prompt them about. You know.
But, give them a little bit of a hint. What kind of things do they come up with there on their own?
Well, a lot of times I think of, you know, fresh fruit and vegetables or water. And I say, well, they would take a barrel to keep water in, but you can't take enough water for the whole journey.
For a trip that long.
You can't take fresh meat either, and so you're going to want meat. How are you going to get the meat? And the boys always have a good answer for that one.
Well, in your list, you have flour, dried corn, coffee, bacon, beans, and dried apples. Did you, just from other research, or did you know specifically that they did this?
No, that's just general, mm-hmm. sort of, that was the usual thing.
Okay. So he takes his tools, the husband does, and her husband's name is Benjamin Kelsey. And he takes his tools and his rifle, bullets. And how were the wagons pulled?
Oxen. That was, sometimes people had mules, but the usual was oxen. Oxen were good and sturdy and reliable, and if worse came to worst, you could eat them.
Well, and
this, it did, and they did.
Yeah. Gives us an idea of how slow the pace would be.
It would be, very slow. With 15 oxen. Miles a day was good. That was a good journey to make.
And Steve Fershad, the illustrator of this book, you have some beautiful oxen pulling this wagon with Ben on his horse on one side of the oxen and Nancy and her baby on a horse on the other side. And you probably have drawn something similar before because you've illustrated a lot of books.
Yes.
So you probably just in your head could come up with these oxen.
Yeah, that would, the oxen part was no problem, but the gear they wore, you know, the yokes and everything was I had to do a little research on, you know, because movies are very deceptive about how it was back then. So, and like I said, Nancy supplied me with photographs, you know, what the men even wore, you know. Like I said, movies are very deceptive how it was in the Old West. So
you researched how these oxen would be attached to the wagon they were pulling.
Exactly.
And what the clothes that Ben, say, for example, was wearing. And everything starts out just so nice and pleasant.
Well, you can imagine
it
would be like a great camping trip at the beginning. But then things happen. They have rivers to cross. They have buffalo they encounter. They have storms. Can I read you about her?
Yeah, well, in fact, she says something that happens on the third day, and they're barely out of Missouri, if they're even out of Missouri for the third day. What happened?
The third day, the Indians towed us across the river in rawhide boats made of buffalo skins. We had to go looking for a picture of that, too.
Yes.
Our oxen swam the river with our wagons.
Those are the words of Nancy Kelsey.
Mm-hmm.
The title of Nancy Leake's book is Nancy Kelsey Comes Over the Mountain, The True Story of the First American Woman in California. So the Indians are quite nice, and they helped them across the river. And you mentioned, she even says there were rawhide boats made of buffalo skins, and the oxen were able to just swim across. And what else, Nancy?
Well, they encounter a tornado. Here I witnessed my first cyclone. It came within a mile of us, and I will never forget the awful sight. I saw trees going through the air with their roots and all, just as they were pulled up from the ground.
And
I really like Steve's illustration of this.
Yeah, I was just going to mention. Steve Fershad, the illustrator of this book, has Nancy and Ben experiencing this cyclone. And how did you come up with that illustration, Steve?
It was just putting myself in that situation, basically. You know, they said one part of being a good illustrator, you have to be a good actor. You know, you have to put yourself in that situation. So I had to pretend what it would feel like, you know, being a man, holding his wife, and his young, just trying his best to protect her, and all the stuff whipping around.
And they don't have much shelter, so you have them hiding, sheltering themselves next to their wagon.
Yes, I illustrator's license. I would assume that it'd be dangerous to stay in the wagon since some wagons were blowing over.
Yeah. My guests are two storytellers. Nancy Leake, who wrote this story of Nancy Kelsey, this pioneer woman, very young. And Steve Fershad tells the story in pictures. So they experience a cyclone. And what else, Nancy, did they experience in her words, in Nancy's words?
Well, the Indians, they were scared of the Indians, actually.
Well, they had reason to be. Now, some Indians helped them across the river, but then they had this guy come wandering back into camp with no clothes on.
Well, yeah, see, they just didn't, they never knew what to expect from the Indians, whether they would be helpful or whether they would be dangerous. Nicholas Dawson goes out hunting. They're on their, you know, midday break, I think, and he goes out hunting by himself. He encounters a party of Indians. They take his rifle, his pistol, his knife, and his clothing. And he runs back into camp, scared to death, shouting that there are thousands of Indians following him. And the immigrants panic. They get their wagons in a circle. They're
like
ready
the
to
movies.
Defend themselves. Just like in the movies.
They circle the wagons. to protect themselves from these Indians who had stripped their friend and stolen all his belongings. And you can kind of see why they might want his gun, but to take his clothes, too.
Yeah, they took everything. And luckily for the Bidwell Bartleson Party, they had an experienced trail guide. They had linked up with a missionary party who had hired a guide, Tom Fitzpatrick. And Tom Fitzpatrick had experience with the Indians, and he could even speak some of their language. So Nancy says, how you would have laughed if you had seen him come into camp one day. He was entirely naked. The Indians had found him and stripped him of all his clothes. We corralled ourselves with our wagons and sent three men out to counsel with them. Fortunately, the chief knew Fitzpatrick, and Fitz knew him. And Fitzpatrick was able to get back everything except the pistol. The Indians kept that. And from then on, Nicholas Dawson, who had an interesting career in California himself, from then on he was known as Cheyenne Dawson.
Because of what the Indians had put him through.
He never lived it down.
And, of course, Steve, I'm sure you had fun drawing the startled expressions on their faces when this naked guy comes walking and yelling into camp.
It's a precarious position to have an illustrator depict nudity in a children's book. So it's just more important just to show the reaction of the people of him walking into camp that way.
And you did this very cleverly.
Oh,
you have his back, and he's shouting to him, and the startled faces of his friends, they're thinking, what in the world? And then the next picture, of course, he's wrapped in a blanket. And
and for me, it was just an irresistible episode in their adventures.
And then you have more of Nancy's words when they go through a herd of buffalo.
Mm-hmm. It was dangerous for us for a week as we traveled through a surging herd of buffalo. We were afraid they would run over us. We stopped for a few days at a large rock and dried meat. And the rock she's referring to is Independence Rock. And settlers would record their names on this rock. And you can still see names carved in the rock at Independence Rock if they carved it. But most of the travelers would either write their name in axle grease or something like that, paint, and they're gone now. I don't know for sure. I know these people did record their names. Nancy doesn't say, you know, who wrote her name up there, but I figured somebody helped her, so I made it John Bidwell.
So you have John Bidwell writing her name in black axle grease on this rock, and you have her asking him to do that. And under her name, he wrote?
Martha Ann, her little girl.
So the two of them have their name on this rock. It would be interesting to visit that rock and see.
Yeah, I have. And you can see names, but the only names you see are the ones that were carved.
Yeah. Well, what happened when they got to Soda Springs?
You know, this is another place where I just surmised that, you know, you'd get to nice, warm, hot springs and you'd want a bath. And you'd want to wash your little girl and wash your clothes. So that's what they did. But this is where they split up. This is the place where the two parties split. One went to Oregon, the others went to California.
And at the time, California was not a part of the United States.
No.
And when they get to California, California doesn't have a flag because it's not a state. And it's fortunate that Nancy Kelsey is skilled at sewing. And you refer to her, or other people perhaps, refer to her as the Betsy Ross of California.
That has been said, but I have not been able to find where she actually says that she sewed the flag. There's not a whole lot of sewing in the California flag. Most of it was painted. I think it's quite likely she sewed the red stripe across the bottom. but what took her a lot more work was she does say, when Fremont arrived, his men had not changed their clothes for a month. A hired woman and myself sewed on shirts every day until all his men had to change. I also baked bread for Fremont during that time. We're talking about 30 men. Plus, of course, and that's in Fremont's group. She was there in Sonoma for the Bear Flag Revolt, and her husband and his brother were part of those bunch of rowdies who decided they were going to take over California. So she was there. She probably did have something to do with the flag. She definitely had a hand in sewing shirts for 30 men.
In fact, Steve, that's what you focused on in your illustration, and I'm sure Nancy was telling you what she imagined this to be. And you have Nancy Kelsey sewing shirts, and in the background you have a soldier in uniform. And
that's Fremont.
Yes, Fremont smelling this bread that she has baked for his men. And you also have an illustration with the flag, the California Republic, and describe that flag that you drew.
What was very rough looking as far as the original flag, and Nancy found a picture of it. She actually was able to find a picture of it. Was that the picture of the original
mm-hmm.
flag? Yes.
Yeah.
And so that's what exactly that is.
So you had the original to go by when
yes.
you were drawing that illustration.
Yes.
Although that original flag is no longer in existence. It burned in the San Francisco fire of 1906.
Oh, so fortunately we have a photograph.
But there was a photo of it, yeah.
Of that. So we don't know if that actually how much sewing she did, but she did have the cloth that the flag was.
Somebody came up with the cloth, yeah. Yeah.
But we do know that she sewed the shirts. The trip across the mountains got pretty difficult. And when I was reading this, I thought, golly, thank goodness she was young, because she really went through a lot.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And yet she always maintained a cheerful outlook.
One of your illustrations, Steve, is when a mule slipped and fell over a cliff. And Nancy writes, Nancy Kelsey looked with horror down the mountainside. Far below, the mule lay on its back, and there was nowhere to reach it or rescue it. And did you have actual information about that happening?
Yes, she does talk about that, and so do some of the other people in the group. And Steve did a great job with that picture. I feel so sorry for that mule.
Yeah, it's a lovely illustration of this mule sliding down the mountain with its pack on. And then you mentioned, Steve, that on the cover, Nancy Kelsey is not wearing shoes. And then on one of your pages, Nancy Leak, you quote Nancy Kelsey saying, I walked barefoot until my feet were blistered.
Mm-hmm.
Read that.
I walked barefoot until my feet were blistered. For 2 days, I had nothing to eat but acorns. One time, I became so weak that I lay down on the ground while Ben went out and killed a deer. That was after they got in the valley. Then he was able to go out and kill a deer.
And then December is when they went to Sutter Sport. And she says on the Sacramento River, but it was actually the American River.
Yeah.
So we were 15 days making the trip in a rowboat rowed by Indians. We arrived at the fort on Christmas Day. Now, she was pregnant at this time.
Yes, and that's not generally known. But John Bidwell, someone wrote a letter to him years later and asked, you know, who was the first American child born in California? And he said, Nancy Kelsey had a baby after she arrived here. So she was pregnant on this journey, but the baby did not survive. Mm-hmm. I mean, that journey was so arduous. You can imagine that it, you know, what could happen.
Yeah. In fact, Steve, I looked at your illustrations a little more closely when I read that she was likely pregnant at that time. And you didn't really show that. I mean, the clothes were rather loose-fitting, but I figured that was the best decision to make.
It was an artistic decision, yes.
Yeah.
But Nancy did inform me that she was mm-hmm. pregnant on the journey.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't really put that in the story. That's in the afterword, though.
Right. At the end of the book, you tell us, give us some more information about Nancy Kelsey that was not included in your narrative with the pictures that Steve drew. It's been such a pleasure talking to the two of you and reading your book about Nancy Kelsey.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, too.
Well, after a break, artist and author Teresa Jordan wonders if Benjamin Franklin's notion of virtue might offer guidance to us today. She calls her book, The Year of Living Virtuously, Weekends Off. Teresa Jordan was selected to tell a story on the Moth Radio Hour this month. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is an artist and author who grew up in a house full of books on an isolated ranch in Wyoming. Teresa Jordan graduated summa cum laude from Yale University with a BA in history, studied creative writing at the University of Montana, and earned a degree in fine arts from the University of Utah. She is the recipient of a literary fellowship from the National Endowment of the Arts and the Western Heritage Award from the Cowboy Hall of Fame for script writing and other awards. With her husband, folklorist, and public radio producer Hal Cannon, Teresa Jordan created The Open Road, a series of radio features for Public Radio International's The Savvy Traveler. Her newest book, The Year of Living Virtuously, Weekends Off, was inspired by Benjamin Franklin's list of 13 virtues and the 7 deadly sins. Teresa's artwork is featured on the book's cover and as illustrations throughout the book. Teresa Jordan, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Well, I thought this was just such a great idea that I was wondering how it came about. How did you get this idea? What was the genesis of this book?
Well, I had written several books before, and then I took a sort of what I like to call midlife expansion into visual art. I went back to school. You mentioned that I got a degree from the University of Utah, and for a while I was really primarily doing visual art. I was still doing some teaching of writing, but I didn't work on a book for several years. And when I wanted to get back to writing seriously again, and was really looking just for sort of a form of practice to get the wheels turning again. When I teach writing, I use a lot of triggers with my students, a lot of different generative ideas. And I thought I wanted to just set up some sort of structure to practice on a regular basis. And I was looking, I was just doing a lot of reading, and I ran across the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, which is a book that I read way back. I was on our family bookshelf. I don't know if I read it in grade school or in junior high. But I've always loved Benjamin Franklin. I mean, who doesn't fall in love with Benjamin Franklin and the kite deal, you know? But I had forgotten that I ran into in this little tiny autobiography of his, I ran across something I totally went over my head as a kid, which was what he deemed his bold and arduous project for moral perfection. I mean, you know, what kid's going to pay attention to that? But this, he set out, and you know, he did this a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but also quite, he was very earnest. He wanted to be a good person. He wanted to be an effective person, and he wanted to play a role in his community. And he set himself out a list of 12 virtues. And a friend looked at it, and he said, well, you know, there's one that's missing, Ben. I think you sort of tend to be a little on the arrogant side. I think you might add humility. So he did add humility. He set out these 13 virtues, and then he drew himself a chart. And even as ambitious as he was, he thought 13 virtues all at once is too much. So each week he thought he would pay attention to one virtue and give himself a black mark on this chart if he felt that he had betrayed that virtue. And he wrote that he hoped by a number of courses of going through these 13 weeks that he would have a clean slate. And then I don't really know how long he followed this. I suspect not really all that long. But at the end of his life, he said he was surprised to find himself so much fuller of fault than he expected, as most of us are. But anyway, I was looking for some sort of structure, and I saw this, and I just laid it out, and I thought, well, my gosh, you know, I mean, Benjamin Franklin would have done this as a blog. You know, if the blog had been around, he would have been all over that. He loved communication, any form of communication. And 13 weeks and then several, you know, 4 courses of that in a year. And it just sort of thought, well, this is, you know, this is a lecture. This is a and the virtues are good triggers, to use that term I use in writing. And I, not being particularly virtuous myself, I've always been quite interested in the 7 deadly sins. So I'm going to add those to the mix and just use those as starting points and see where that goes.
My guest is Teresa Jordan, and she has written a collection of illustrated essays, The Year of Living Virtuously, weekends off. And I just thought that was human nature, that the friend looks at Benjamin's list and says, you know, I think you should add whatever it is, because I think if we were looking at a friend or family member, we'd want to say, yeah, why don't you add this? And as I was looking at this list, I thought, well, Benjamin Franklin, where is the word patience on there? The virtue of patience. We always hear patience is a virtue. That wasn't on Benjamin Franklin's list. I looked for things like truthfulness. He did say sincerity, so I guess he covered it there. But As I was reading, I kept thinking how I would edit this list, and that's what you have done. And you included other, as you said, other virtues. So Benjamin Franklin came up with this list of virtues that you elaborated on, and you include personal anecdotes. But since you are an artist, why don't you describe the cover of your book for us?
Well, the cover of that book is actually a surprise. It was a surprise to me when they chose that. And for the illustrations inside, I knew inside the book it needed to be black and white. It needed to be readable in black and white. I wanted something that was quite graphic. I wanted to work with the idea of a theory that animals and elements of nature working as metaphors for virtue and vice, very old concept in the Middle Ages and Christianity, and really fables of animals and trees and birds carry moral teachings of virtue and vice in most cultures. So I wanted to do something sort of blockly, sort of like a woodblock prints for the inside of the book. I thought that we would have something like that on the outside, and I had, you know, had sketched out some ideas that I sent them, and they felt for the outside that was too quiet. But I had one subject that I have done a lot of is chickens, and I just love chickens, and I think they're, you know, the texture and everything of their feathers and their shape and their colors are just very, very fun. And I've done quite a few whimsical pieces of chickens, and my editor, I had actually sent him a card that had one of my chickens on, and he said, you know, we really want to see some of your chickens. So I sent him some of the chicken pieces, and their designer just really liked that, and particularly this one that is of a chicken looking at an apple. And, you know, the apple is sort of a deep and old symbol of virtue or vice. And I guess that just sort of tickled them, the idea of a chicken looking at an apple. So there is a chicken on the cover looking at an apple.
My guest is Teresa Jordan, and she is telling us about the cover of her book, The Year of Living Virtuously, Weekends Off, because she is also an artist, as well as an essayist, poet, been on radio. And Teresa decided to live by Benjamin Franklin's list of virtues for a year, taking weekends off to focus on the seven deadly sins. Now, we're talking about virtue and we're talking about sins, but do we even know what we're talking about? I mean, how do you define virtue?
You know, I first off, I want to say that I'm interested in this in a very non-dogmatic way, and I really believe in the middle way. I think an excess of anything is you can turn an excess of anything into a vice, and certainly you look at terrorism around the world, which is an excess of religious zeal, and I was never interested in trying to come up with the answer with how I should act in every circumstance or how someone else would. I was interested in what makes us kind and effective members of our community. What do we mean when we call someone a good person? How do we repair our transgressions? What does it mean to live an authentic life? And these are very old questions, and on a daily basis they underscore our actions. One of my favorite of all tragedies is King Lear, and you know, King Lear, this great Shakespearean tragedy. King Lear, what started his tragic flaw wasn't that he was a bad person. He was not a murderer. He didn't commit genocide. He didn't abuse people. But he was arrogant. He had a very rigid idea of what of how he wanted his daughters to express their love to him. He was hungry for flattery. He was blind to the authentic and sincere devotion of his youngest daughter. He couldn't hear the advice of his best friend. And from there, all hell broke loose. And these are, you know, there's not a week that goes by that some of us don't, you know, that most of us don't have one or more of those trespasses. So I really was, when the subtitle is A Search for Meaning in an Ordinary Life, I'm really talking about this on a very human scale. I for the most part, don't get into politics. I don't get into the really, you know, the big scandals. I don't get into the things that are on the daily news. I wanted to understand much more with what was around the daily dinner table.
And you also say that you liked your husband's definition of virtue. In fact, I thought your dedication to your book was amusing. Who did you dedicate your book to?
I dedicated it to my husband, and he is a musician, and he's plays traditional stringed instruments, and he is quite wonderful on the banjo. He just sort of takes the banjo into territories it hasn't been before. And so I dedicated it to my husband, the patron saint of banjos and other more highly strung instruments.
And then your husband had a definition of virtue, making the world go backward, well, of vice, sin, making the world go backward through human action. So then if that's vice, that's sin, then virtue, you would be helping the world go forward, making the world go forward through human action.
Right. And that, I actually used that in the introduction. I liked his that just very simple definition of sin. And then I thought, well, that works pretty well on the other side, too. It's helping the world go forward through human action.
And then you mentioned that any virtue taken too far can become a vice. I was particularly interested in Benjamin Franklin's industry. He's considered industry a virtue. And he said, lose no time, always be employed in something meaningful, something useful, and cut off all unnecessary actions. He says, lose no time and always be employed in something useful. That's such a Western idea that I wondered, because I have to watch that one myself. I've had to learn to not be doing all the time. And so I wondered if you considered looking farther from Western culture, looking to the East, to China and India, for your ideas of virtues.
I did, very much. And, you know, this Western sense of industry, which is to always be busy and to always be occupied. And Benjamin Franklin was a complex person, and he certainly, you know, he wrote these definitions of virtue when he was a very young man, when he started this project. And he was a very industrious man. He worked, and he's also famous for the saying, time is money. He didn't actually coin that, but it's often attributed to him. And
because frugality was one of the virtues.
And frugality is one of the virtues. But he also had a great appreciation of time with people, of time in conversation, of understanding people, of listening to them. And one of the chapters in the book is titled The Hard Work of Staying Still. And it set at a time I did a retreat at a Trappist monastery here in Utah that's up in the Ogden Valley. And the Trappists, I thought before I went there that they observed a vow of silence. They don't, they don't talk much. They talk about the charity of silence, of not filling people's lives and your interactions with them with idle talk. But they also talk about the importance of saying the right thing at the right time and in the right way. And while I was up there, I observed the hours, the seven services a day that the Trappists observe, and I spent most of my time in silence. And I did at that time, as I had before and as I do since, but there's a wonderful liturgy, literature from wisdom traditions all over the world, including Western traditions. There's a very strong contemplative movement within Christianity. Mindfulness and silent meditation is deeply ingrained in the Buddhist tradition, and so many traditions have. That is what prayer is, after all, is a chance to retreat from the chatter of the day in an attempt to hear that small, still voice within, or to allow a greater understanding to reach you. And if there was one thing through the course of this year that just kept coming up over and over, it is that how often our transgressions, the things we do where we don't attend to someone who needs our attention, we don't attend to tasks that need our attention, we're short with somebody, or we just are completely distracted from even understanding that somebody in our life needs attention. It so often comes because we have so much on our mind. We are so busy that we're really pulled off the center of who it is we want to be and how we want to act in the world.
My guest is Teresa Jordan, and her book is a collection of illustrated essays, The Year of Living Virtuously, Weekends Off. She decided to live by Benjamin Franklin's list of virtues for a year, taking weekends off to focus on the seven deadly sins. And you were talking about silence. And in your chapter on silence, you admit to being a talker, and you say, at times I listen well or settle into a deep meditation, but when I'm excited or anxious or happy or insecure or defensive, in other words, most of the time, I babble on, and I have a tendency to narrate the world around me. And it was amusing when you said this, because you mentioned that you were irritated by a friend who had this trait.
Don't you think we're most irritated by those when we see those traits in others that we really wish we didn't have?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it pushes a button.
This is a sort of funny story, and I have a great interest in both cognitive science and the incredible work that's being done, and great understanding that's being done in how our minds work, and how that interaction between neurology and behavior. I also have a real interest in meditation and in Buddhist practice. And I had the chance several years ago to a conference held that was sponsored by MIT with the Dalai Lama and a number of Buddhist monks and a number of cognitive scientists from around the world. And these are conferences that the Dalai Lama has had on an annual basis now for, I think, close to 25 years. But that was the first one that had been open to the public. And I was very interested in, and I was able to go. And a friend of mine who's a professor at the University of Miami also wanted to go. And so the two of us roomed together and went to this together. And I am a talker, but my gosh, she puts me to shame. And she just, you know, during this conference had started, and she just kept talking to me and sort of responding to everything anybody was saying. And I just, all I wanted to do was listen. I just found myself getting more and more frustrated. And finally, the Dalai Lama started to talk, and she was still, talking. And I kept sort of trying to give her little hand signals, and she wasn't taking them. And, finally, gave her a shh. But what I really wanted to do was just yell at her, you know, can't you shut up? Can't you see I'm trying to learn about compassion?
And then you caught yourself in the irony of the situation.
Yes.
Well, you mentioned sources that what you learned, for example, from E.B. White. What did you learn from him?
You know, I start the book with an essay of him. He was a favorite writer growing up with Charlotte's Web, and then a wonderful writer at the New Yorker, and I just love his essays. I am an essayist. I love the essay because you can draw connections from so many different things, and he's probably the best of all time at doing that. But he wrote at different times quite a bit about resolution. And there's one piece that he wrote. He had a farm in New England, and there was one piece he wrote where he talked about getting the farm ready for winter, and he wrote a list, I forget now exactly how many things, but dozens and dozens of things that should be done in the farm before winter. And the pleasure he was taking in listing these, and it was very clear that a good number of those things were never going to get done. But a good many of them were. And by simply laying them out, it put order in his life. It gave him a place to start. And he wrote about the difference between saving the world, that he woke up every morning with a torn between the desire to savor the world, to just go out and watch, or to save the world, which is to sit in the chair and do. And again, it's really this that we were just talking about, the difference between action and sitting back and enjoying or contemplating. But it was a fun place to start a piece on resolution for the new year.
My guest is Teresa Jordan, and she has written a collection of essays, illustrated essays, called The Year of Living Virtuously, Weekends Off. And you also describe in your book what you learned from Terry Waite.
Yes. One of Benjamin Franklin's virtues is tranquility. And I struggle with anxiety, and I'm not terribly debilitated by anxiety, but I struggle with anxiety. It's something that affects me frequently, and so I'm very interested in tranquility. It's one reason I like a meditation practice. It helps me just stay rooted and stay calm. But when I wanted to write about it, I thought, I'm so deeply moved and informed by the stories of people who are able to find tranquility and balance and meaning in conditions that just terrify me. And one thing that just has, I was a precocious reader. I read Leon Uris's book, Exodus, as very young, and which is a story of the Holocaust and of the concentration camps. And maybe it started there, but I just have an almost a deep fear of being incarcerated and of being held hostage in some way or another. And the story of Terry Waite, who was an envoy for the Anglican Church in the Middle East and who had negotiated many hostage releases, and he himself was taken hostage in Lebanon and held for, I believe it was close to 5 years, in horrendous circumstances. He was mostly in solitary confinement. He was mostly held in a dark room. He was mostly chained to the floor. And yet he found in that the mental fortitude to survive as a whole person. And he found, too, moments of tremendous tranquility and grace. And so, too, I've always felt that I can learn so much from other people's stories. If someone can survive in that unspeakable experience, they have a lot to teach me that's helpful in just my daily passage. That was the one virtue that I actually wrote two chapters on, and I wrote about Terry Waite, who is hostage, and I also wrote about professor in Salt Lake City, Brooke Hopkins, who had just retired from the university, was just weeks from after retirement, and was in a terrible bike accident and was completely paralyzed from the neck down, and just had he and his wife, who was a medical ethicist, ironically, whose work had centered for her whole professional career, which is her work is used all over the world, but on end of life issues, and so they're really, you know, facing this question of what is a life worth living. Brooke could not be kept alive without life support, when you choose life and what you make of it. And Brooke lived for 5 years. At the end of that time, he asked to have life support removed. But he had an extraordinary last 5 years. He continued to, he had to learn to breathe and to talk on an intubation. He had almost no muscles in his lungs, so he completely had to learn to breathe again. And he was just one of the most beautiful people I've ever met. He went back to teaching as soon as he had learned to talk again. The beauty of the life that he and Peggy created around themselves, the life of friendship and of teaching and of engagement, it's just an amazing story.
Well, you say that other people, in circumstances like you've just described, other people have found tranquility. You came up with a motto, other people can do it. If somebody else can do it, I can. It's possible. If other people have found tranquility, I can. Do you still follow that motto, Teresa?
I believe that, you know, and I don't know where that came from. I grew up on a ranch, and there you pretty much had to figure out how to do stuff on your own. But from as far back as I can think, and it wasn't, you know, other people do it. Mom, they're going to the dance, so you have to let me go to the dance. But just that thing that, you know, I remember I broke my first horse when I was about 13, and just, you know, feeling other people can figure out how to do this. I can figure out how to do this. When I decided to have a freelance life, it's possible for people to make a living as a freelance writer. It's possible. You know, I'm not trying to walk to the moon. So if they can do it, I should be able to figure out how to do it. And the way that I go about that generally is really looking at other people's stories and just trying to learn as much as possible about how they actually did make something work.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Teresa, about your book. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure for me.
And I'd also like to thank my other two storytellers, Nancy Leek, whose new book is Nancy Kelsey Comes Over the Mountain, The True Story of the First American Woman in California, and award-winning artist and illustrator Steve Fershad, who illustrated this new book about Nancy Kelsey. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Weekman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.